Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Coming up in a few minutes, WFPL Stephanie Sanders speaks with Roland Paris. He's an expert on international security, foreign policy, and international affairs, and says the United States' involvement in Afghanistan may be more complicated than many Americans think. But first, we're entering the third week of January, and many people may start struggling with their New Year's resolutions. WFPL's Julie Goodwin spoke with registered dietitian Margaret Hine about strategies for losing weight in 2007 and events the Metro Health Department has sponsored to help you along the way.
Margaret, why did the health department decide to offer the weight management classes?
We've been offering some of them for a number of years, mainly because obesity is a big problem in Kentucky as well as over the whole nation. Kentucky is actually number three in the nation in terms of most overweight and obese, so we do have a big problem here.
How will these classes be structured?
The strategies for successful weight loss, those classes are just a one-hour class. It's a PowerPoint presentation, and it covers, there's a study called the National Weight Control Registry. So it studies the strategies that have worked for people who have lost at least 30 pounds and kept their weight off for at least 5 years. So basically we're covering the successful strategies of these people. And then we have how to start a weight support group, and that's also a PowerPoint presentation which helps people, even if they want to start a weight support group informally with friends or if they want to do it at their work site, or at a place of worship or some group that they're with, it provides them with copy-ready originals and materials that they can use, a lot of ideas for fun activities that they can do with their group, and just kind of the basics of how to start the groundwork to do that. But it can be very informal even with just their own friends. And then another type of thing that we offer four times a year, we offer a weight control series, which is a series of four classes, 1.5 hour each, where people learn. Actually, we start out doing a body fat and their weight and finish about 4 months later just doing a recheck. But some of the topics we cover in that would be, again, some of the basic strategies for weight loss. We provide them with a meal plan with a personal calorie level, grocery strategies, how to cook light, eating on the go, and also some of the most common pitfalls for weight loss and how to deal with those.
What tips would you suggest to someone interested in becoming healthier?
One thing is definitely, if they need to lose weight, to try to lose weight. Exercise, a lot of us are not getting enough exercise. I recommend that for people who have not been exercising, to start off very gradually, something really realistic, even if it's just 5 minutes every other day, and then just very gradually increase that. It's also a good idea for people not to jump in doing a lot of changes all at once, but to pick one thing at a time. Like, for instance, if a person eats a lot of fried foods, to maybe start out by saying, one day a week I'm going to avoid fried foods, and then increasing that the next week to 2 days and doing it gradually. Or if somebody's not eating many vegetables, maybe saying, okay, I'm doing well if I even eat one vegetable a day, and work on that, and then work up maybe the next week to 2 vegetables, and then finally up to 3, which is actually the minimum we should be eating. So, you know, work on one change at a time. Another one might be if somebody eats a lot of rich desserts and snacks, to maybe begin substituting healthier foods little by little, so that that way you're not making so many changes at once that it's really hard to do.
Do you see a lot of people who try to, perhaps at the beginning of a new year, say, well, I'm just going to lose a lot of weight and make all these changes, but then they just can't stick with it because their goals are unrealistic?
Right, and that's what I was just talking about, that it's better to, instead of trying to do everything perfect right off, to just work on one thing at a time and make gradual changes that are realistic because, you know, our habits are deeply ingrained, so it's really difficult to try to change too much at once. It's too stressful. It's too much depriving a person of what they like. So just making those changes gradually. And also it affects our schedules and things because making changes can take time. And it takes time to even learn how to shop for different foods and read labels. So doing too much at once is just too demanding for a person to keep up with.
Many people might think that they have to join a gym or something like that in order to have exercise that counts. But what are some tips, some different exercises people might be able to do where they don't necessarily have to go to a gym?
Okay, it's found to be really helpful for people to get small amounts of exercise throughout the day. So, for instance, they may take the stairs at work instead of taking the elevator. They may park farther away when they have to go somewhere, so they get a little exercise on the way. If they're going to the mall, maybe park at the opposite end so they walk through the mall. Instead of constantly emailing people, you might walk, especially if they're upstairs, walk to their office to talk to them, working and things like that, and even just at home, maybe walking in the neighborhood, keeping some exercise shoes in the car so that if you happen to drive by a nice place to walk or a park, then it would be real easy to work that in. So, and even, you know, while you're watching TV, doing some exercise while watching TV, personally, that's how I get my exercise, is just working it in different ways like that.
Margaret Hine, thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed talking to you.
To learn more about the health department's programs, you can go to louisvilleky.gov/health or visit our website at wfpl.org. Many Americans' minds are still on the war in Iraq, especially after last week's announcement that the president wants to increase U.S. troop involvement in the conflict. But U.S. troops are still involved in violence elsewhere in the world, especially Afghanistan. Roland Paris is the 2007 recipient of the University of Louisville's Grawemeyer Award for Ideas Improving World Order. His book, At War's End, Building Peace After Civil Conflict, discusses lessons learned in the 1990s and how they can be applied to the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan and Iraq. He spoke with WFPL Stephanie Sanders.
What do you think is the biggest misconception most people have about what's going on in Afghanistan?
Well, I should just start by saying that the award was for my book, which really focused on a whole series of post-conflict peace-building missions in the 1990s, really from 1989 through to about 2000. So the book doesn't focus really on Afghanistan and its current situation. But in terms of any misconceptions that there might be about conditions in Afghanistan, I think one of the misconceptions is that there are sufficient international forces in Afghanistan to deal with the rising problem of the insurgency, which is itself largely based in neighboring Pakistan. So when the post-conflict period in Afghanistan began, there was a decision made to leave a relatively small number of international troops behind in Afghanistan, about 4,000 NATO soldiers in the capital of Kabul, and then about 8,000 U.S. troops outside of the capital, whose primary mission was not to reconstruct or to do traditional peacekeeping, but rather to hunt down the remaining remnant elements of the Taliban and al-Qaeda. And that decision really was a decision to pursue peace building and reconstruction in Afghanistan in a kind of minimalist way. And even though the number of troops, international forces in Afghanistan has been increased gradually over time, and even though NATO has expanded its area of responsibility beyond the capital, Kabul, to the rest of the country, the mission in Afghanistan remains, surprisingly, I think, to many, one of the most under-resourced international stabilization missions since World War II. And you can measure that in terms of the number of international forces there are as a percentage of the population of Afghanistan, and also in terms of the amount of aid that's going for reconstruction in Afghanistan. Many other countries, even the Solomon Islands or Bosnia, Kosovo, that have had post-conflict missions, have received more aid on a per capita basis than Afghanistan. So I think one of the misconceptions is that Afghanistan is really a mission that has been taken fully seriously by the United States, by the international community, and by NATO, whereas in fact I think that it's largely been a mission that's been conducted on the cheap, and we're dealing with the consequences of that right now.
Well, and I was just reading recently about the most recent meeting of some of the NATO members, and it appears to be that some of them are still a little hesitant about, I guess, adding support to the mission there. And you've mentioned some of the consequences. I mean, if this continues, what will be the effect?
Well, it's true that there's been disagreement among the NATO members about, really disagreements about whether their own troops should be, number one, deployed to Afghanistan, and number two, even if they're in Afghanistan, whether they should be put into the most dangerous parts of the country. And only a few NATO members have deployed their troops into the most dangerous parts of the country, namely the south and the east, and that includes the United States and Britain and Canada and the Dutch. And many of the other countries, even that have troops, NATO countries that have troops in Afghanistan, have restrictions on what those troops can do, restrictions that are essentially aimed at keeping them out of harm's way. So there's a great deal of concern, I think, on the part of observers that NATO has some internal management issues and some negotiation that still needs to be done among its various different members in order to ensure that all the members of NATO are on the same page and that there's a real commitment to put the kind of resources, not just military but also development resources, into Afghanistan that's going to be needed in order to reverse what is really a slow slide, a gradual deterioration in conditions, especially over the past year or so. What might happen if that commitment is not made is, I fear, a gradual continued worsening of conditions. And what I mean by that is a gradual continued strengthening of the insurgency, an insurgency which, as I mentioned earlier, is largely based in neighboring Pakistan, an insurgency that has been using more sophisticated techniques and using bombing and suicide bombing, which are methods that really weren't known in Afghanistan and have been imported largely from the insurgency in Iraq. And I guess really a matter of great concern is how ordinary Afghans are thinking about this entire operation and their own prospects, because really my understanding is that most ordinary Afghans just want security and opportunity for themselves and for their families. And I fear that if conditions continue to worsen gradually, that ordinary Afghans will lose hope in both the government of Hamid Karzai, that is the government of Afghanistan, and also in the international mission. We haven't reached that point yet. I think the prospects are still reasonably good for success in Afghanistan, but we need to address the fact that there is a gradual deterioration in conditions, and the only way to address that is really to devote the kind of military and development resources that this country is always needed from after the Taliban were driven from power.
Is it anything that
Are these answers too long, by the way?
No.
Okay.
I think they're perfect.
Okay, good.
I
like you.
Is this anything that a single country, and I understand that you're saying that the awareness isn't there of how large a problem this is and nobody's really taking it on in the way that should be, that it should be taken. But say that awareness suddenly came about in one particular country. Is it something that one country could do, or do you think that the collaboration of NATO is needed in this situation?
Well, I think there is a growing awareness of the seriousness of the situation in Afghanistan. I mean, to be fair, NATO has redeployed its forces and it's strengthened its forces, and it is seeking an additional 2,500 troops. So there are efforts also to accelerate the delivery of development aid, and there are the comments that have been made by NATO military and civilian officials on the ground in Afghanistan indicate that they're aware of the danger of a further deterioration. I think the key question is whether there is a political will on the part of the members of NATO to really face the kind of resource requirements that would be required in order to, I think, address these deteriorating circumstances. And that will probably mean additional troops, more money, and more resources for the training of the Afghan army, which is something that has been going fairly well but slowly. A reform of the police service, which is completely corrupt and completely dysfunctional, and it's delegitimizing the Hamid Karzai government in its daily dealings with ordinary Afghans. And also getting serious about the problem of terrorist safe havens and training camps right across the border in Pakistan. So I'm not convinced that there's any magic solution here, or that any one country can wave a magic wand and bring this kind of commitment into existence. But I think NATO as an organization, and the leading member of NATO, the United States, if you don't mind my saying, as a Canadian, but the organization really needs to really think through the implications of its own analysis that this may be a turning point in the mission. It will need more than just a few more troops in the south of the country. It's going to need to make a major commitment of military and diplomatic and development resources. And unlike Iraq, where I think the prospects of really stabilizing that country with the existing mission are very low, I think the chances of producing an Afghanistan which is reasonably stable are still good. And so it's not too late to really recognize that early decisions of resourcing this the Afghanistan operation, which were minimalist commitments, that those decisions can be corrected.
That's a great segue, because I wanted to talk to you a little bit about Iraq.
Sure.
I realize that the specifics of the two areas are quite different.
Yeah.
But do you feel like the area of maybe being under-resourced is the same, or is it completely different as well?
Well, the situation in Iraq and Afghanistan are so different for so many different reasons. One of the key differences is that in Iraq, you have what looks a lot like a civil war going on right now. And whether you want to call it a civil war or not, it looks like one. Whereas in Afghanistan, you still have a situation where the vast majority of the population are not engaged in the conflict, and they're broadly supportive of the government and of the international reconstruction efforts. And in Afghanistan further, the Taliban and its allies still have fairly limited presence in the country and are still using foreign bases in Pakistan. So the situations right off the bat are quite different. In addition, you know, my own research has focused more on how to help countries move from a post-war situation into a more durable peace. And what's emerged in Iraq is what is in effect an ongoing war, now what seems like a civil war. And so the kind of my research, the lessons of my book, are not as applicable to what to do in an ongoing conflict situation than they are in what to do right after a conflict. Now, having said that, there's lots of lessons, I think, from the experience of the 1990s and different kinds of missions after conflicts that could help us understand the kinds of errors that may have been made by decision makers, U.S. decision makers and planners in the immediate post-war period right after the fall of Baghdad. And there's no doubt, and this has been acknowledged now by officials who were involved, including Paul Bremer and others, that there was just not a sufficient plan to have a very robust security force and military and police presence ready to be deployed throughout the country in order to prevent the kind of vacuum of authority that emerged in the immediate aftermath of the fall of the Saddam Hussein regime, and to prevent that vacuum from being exploited and turned into a kind of looting chaos situation. And in some respects, the Iraq hasn't really recovered even from that first week of looting. So there are a number of lessons about filling vacuums of authority immediately after conflict that come out of the 1990s that could have been applied, I think, in the post-war situation to Iraq. In fact, there were a lot of people who had studied these previous missions who were saying, we very much hope that there will be a very robust police force, whether it's international or U.S. or civilian or military, it didn't really matter, but a very robust police force that could be deployed right after areas of the country were, in a sense, being liberated and right after the fall of the regime. So the topic and subject matter of my book really focuses more on that, what to do in the post-conflict period in order to prevent conflict from reigniting. And to the extent that my book is relevant to Iraq at all, it really allows us to maybe understand some of the mistakes that were made and why fighting resumed. And it doesn't really offer a lot of insight in how to deal with an ongoing civil war, which is what appears to be going on in Iraq right now.
Well, talking about some of the lessons from your book, I guess it seems to me as a non-expert in this field that each situation and each different area would need to be different. Is that not the case?
That is absolutely the case. Each mission is completely different. And it's different not only because the conditions, local conditions, and the conflict conditions in each country are different, but also because in many cases you get different kinds of international actors who are involved in the missions themselves. Most of these missions have not been run by one country. They've been managed by a collection of international agencies. They've been really multilateral missions. And the various different constellations of international agencies differ from one mission to the next. So they are, in some senses, difficult to compare. On the other hand, it is possible to draw out some similarities across the missions and to talk about things that worked and things that didn't work. And one of the things that I identify in my book is that for all the missions that were conducted, that were launched in the 1990s, and I looked at 14 of them, there was an effort, almost an unspoken strategy, to transform those countries into market democracies, so to democratize them and introduce market economics in a very quick manner. So there were patterns, recurring patterns across these different operations, despite their many differences. And what was interesting to me to look at the outcomes of these missions was to see that that oftentimes there was much excessively optimistic expectations about the degree to which a holding an election right after a conflict or initiating market-oriented reforms right after a conflict would create the conditions for peace. In many cases, especially in the early 1990s, a little bit less so in the latter 1990s, international peacekeepers would go into a country after a civil war, hold an election, initiate some economic reforms, declare success, and withdraw, and then the progress that had been made on the ground might be rolled back, or a kind of newly emerged democratic government might be taken over by non-democrats and dictator, or revert to civil war. So one of the lessons of my book, I think, one of the findings was that, and maybe it seems self-evident, but it certainly wasn't to those who were running the operations at the time, that if you want to initiate these kinds of political and economic reforms, and if you want to transform post-conflict societies into democracies and market economies, then it needs to be a long-term enterprise where you're really building the institutional foundations for democracy and a market to last, to stick, and to function. And without those institutional foundations, elections and economic privatization and economic marketization measures can be largely superficial. They might not last. And in fact, in some cases, they can provoke additional problems that weren't anticipated.
All right, Roland Paris, Grawmeier Award winner for Improving World Order. Congratulations again, and thanks for spending some time with me.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
When we come back, we'll hear part of a forum held last week about education and its role in Louisville's growth. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Coming up in a few minutes, WFPL's Julie Goodwin speaks with Lana Versalis from the Speed Art Museum about some upcoming events at that facility. But first, education's role in Louisville's growth was the focus of discussion last week at the Louisville Forum Luncheon. An initiative called the Greater Louisville Project has set some goals to help the city grow and be competitive in areas such as education and employment. WFPL brings you a portion of the presentation made by several panelists at the forum.
Leading off will be Carolyn Gatz, the director of the Greater Louisville Project. She will be followed by, not be followed by bank executive Mary Griffith, I regret to say, by University of Louisville Provost Shirley Willingans, Jefferson Community and Technical College President Anthony Newberry, and finally Julie Skosky, who directs adult and continuing education for the Jefferson County School System. Carolyn Gatz brought to the Competitive City Project skills born of her 15 years as a reporter and editorial writer, and then formidable achievements as a consultant in civic initiatives, as an aide to Mayor Abramson, and a deed at the White House. I'll mention just one of them, the $179 million Parc Duval neighborhood revitalization. Carolyn Gatz to begin with.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for inviting us to be with you today. Over the next few moments, I want to ask you to step back, take a break from your busy day and while you eat your lunch, and focus with me on the big picture of the Louisville region and its future. I want to invite you to engage in thinking about how to move Louisville into the top tier of American cities, as Bob said. We're here really to consider a call to action, a call to accelerate the pace of positive change going on in our community. We're going to talk about research commissioned by the Greater Louisville Project that suggests a civic agenda around three key goals designed to accelerate the pace of change and ensure a better future for our community. We call these key goals, as Bob said, deep drivers, because they are fundamental in their potential to move the Louisville region forward. This research projects or quantifies how much progress we have to make in order to catapult Louisville into the top tier among its peer cities in three key areas. And you'll see this at your place. There's a copy both of our public report card that Bob alluded to and then of the deep driver goals. So, in three key areas, education, jobs, and balancing regional growth. Today, we're going to focus on the education goal and call upon the distinguished members of our panel to probe what it means and to discuss its implications in light of the work of Dr. Comer, the winner of the Grawemeyer Award in Education. Now, the Greater Louisville Project is an initiative designed to help make the most of the new level of unity that came to our community with the creation of Louisville Metro Government. This project was convened by the Community Foundation of Louisville and is sponsored by a consortium of foundations, and we are very grateful for their wisdom and foresight in undertaking this work. 5 years ago, the Greater Louisville Project commissioned the Brookings Institution report entitled A Competitive Vision for the Regional City of Louisville. It spelled out our strengths and weaknesses compared to other cities and our challenges for the future in light of global economic competitiveness and the flat world, you know, that we all know is emerging. 2 years ago, we honed the Brookings Report into this competitive city agenda, into key indicators, and created a public report card to track our progress. And as Bob said, at this very moment, we are preparing the second edition of this report card that will be released in a community conversation on February the 9th. So we invite you to join in that conversation and in all of the hard work it will take to achieve these goals. This new edition of the public report card, I just have to say before we go any further, will demonstrate clearly, based on 2005 data in the census update, that we can, as a community, if we want to, set a course to change how we rank on important measures like education attainment. I'm not going to give you the whole story. You'll have to wait for the report card, you know, to see what I mean. But trust me, it's going to show that we can do this if we want to. We can, if we have the civic will and the commitment, redefine who we are as a skilled and educated community that plays to win in the 21st century economy and the heightened competition for jobs, talent, opportunity, and quality of life. The challenge is how to do it, how to unite our community behind a few big but attainable goals and organize action to achieve them. Last summer, we boiled all of this down to these deep drivers of change, a few big but attainable goals that can inform our civic agenda and build on the momentum of merger to take us beyond merger from the good to the greater Louisville that is our aspiration as a community. Our idea is that if we move ahead aggressively in a few key areas, we will improve our overall standing and prepare our young people to compete for a brighter future. By 2010, in each of these three areas, or deep drivers, we need to move from the bottom tier in our rankings among our peer cities into the top tier, or the top five as we are defining it. First, our population must become more educated all across the board, from GEDs to PhDs. Students in kindergarten through 12th grade must perform at grade level, as everyone reads says, and our schools need to achieve world-class standards in math and science, and then go on to post-secondary school. Second, we must make a focused, concerted effort to attract the jobs those higher-skilled workers will need and raise the median family income. And third, we must focus on regional cooperation while strengthening Jefferson County to protect the healthy balance of job and population growth across our entire region, which covers, you know, counties both in Kentucky and Indiana. In other words, we as a community and as a region must connect the dots between education, jobs, and healthy growth as a region. Now, the deepest of these deep drivers is education. Every advance we make as a community, every opportunity that comes our way, will depend on the education and skills of our people. During the decade from 1990 to 2000, Louisville was third in the rate of improvement in the number of young adults aged 25 to 34 who hold a bachelor's degree. But we have a long way to go to catch up in education, so we must accelerate the pace if we want to leapfrog ahead of our competitor cities. So we asked our research partners at U of L, Michael Price and his team, to calculate precisely what it would take. And the answer is that we need 10,000 more young adults with bachelor's degrees. We need to double the projected growth in the number of young adults with a bachelor's degree from 5,000 to 10,000 and bring about comparable increases in high school graduation, associate degrees, and technical certificates. Second, we need to ensure that if our community steps up to the plate in raising education attainment, the high-skilled jobs will be there. We proposed a focus on jobs in the professional and technical category, jobs in science and technology, engineering, healthcare, finance, education management, and the arts, knowledge-based jobs that build strength in the 21st century economy. High-wage jobs require high skills. They depend first and foremost on the skills of our workforce. So again, it's all about connecting the dots between education, jobs, income, and opportunity. But third, we need to forge a new level of regional cooperation while strengthening Jefferson County as the regional hub. To keep our core strong, we must step up our focus on revitalization and rebuilding our city's distressed neighborhoods. Now, particularly in light of our topic today, it is important to note that this goal to strengthen our core relates to the first two goals in ways that might not be immediately apparent. Distressed neighborhoods are tough on children and families, and children who grow up in poverty cannot always make it up the education ladder without support beyond what schools alone can provide. So we must strengthen our core neighborhoods in order to strengthen our region and ensure a better life for families. It's all connected, education, jobs, and healthy regional growth. So we as a community have momentum. What we are saying is that we need to accelerate the pace of change. The way is clear to unite behind one vision for our future and a coherent, powerful civic agenda to achieve it. We welcome your insight and engagement in that effort. As a community, we have proved that we can accomplish great change when we put our mind to it. We have distinguished ourselves as a community that can set a big goal and stick to it. Now we need to set the biggest goal, to redefine who we are as an educated and skilled community that plays to win in the knowledge economy and claims its place in the top tier of American cities. Thank you.
Thank you, Carolyn Getz, and we're assured that this goal can be reached with safety belts well attached. For the university view of reaching the 2010 education attainment goals, we'll turn now to Dr. Shirley Willingans, U of L's Executive Vice President and Provost. I can hardly introduce her without noting that in my own years of service with the Dean's Office in the U of L College of Arts and Sciences, I saw the wise and human sides of Shirley Willingans. With a Ph.D. from the University of Illinois, she came to U of L in 1985 and served on the communications faculty and in the ANS Dean's Office before becoming acting provost in 2002 and 3 years ago, fully empowered. Provost Shirley Willingans.
Thank you, everyone. I think as most of you know, the University of Louisville is part of the state system here in Kentucky. And back in 1997-98, House Bill 1 clearly set a chart, a roadmap for us for what we needed to become as a university. That House Bill says that we will become a premier, nationally recognized metropolitan research university. And I think as we have been working over the last 10 years to really articulate that vision and keep moving forward toward achieving that goal, one of the drivers for us, of course, has been the needs of the region and the city of Louisville. We have mapped a lot of what we've been trying to do around the Boyle Report that I know Carolyn was very involved in bringing forward. And really that report recognized that if Louisville is to move forward, education is going to be a centerpiece, and education that drives us toward these knowledge jobs will be a key thing that has to be accomplished if the city is to achieve all that it's going to do. We've been working really hard on that, and many of you may have seen news reports early in the fall where we talked about our 10-year goals and how we had actually achieved most of those 2 years before schedule. We talked a lot about how our research profile has gone up. We have been named as the fastest-growing university in the country in terms of the extramural dollars that we've attracted. So not in terms of the dollar amounts, but in terms of the percentage increase, we are the fastest-growing university in the country. We've gone from about $14 million in sponsored research in 1996 to about $78 million in federally funded research now, $178 million if you look at all sources of research. If you look at our academic profile, again, we have been moving forward phenomenally. Our graduation rates back in 1996-97 were about 31-32%. Our most recent numbers were 41%. That's a 10% increase in that amount of time, which is just huge in terms of the number of graduates. The students coming into the university, we keep enrolling our largest courses and our largest numbers of students and students with the best academic profile. So again, if you just look at ACT scores, we've gone from about a 21% to a 24.2%. So, and if you look at our commitment to this community, I think many of you who've heard Dr. Ramsey talk about what it means to be a citizen university or how basically the state will move forward depending on how well the city of Louisville moves forward, and the city of Louisville will move forward depending on how well the university can keep its commitments to you in terms of the kind of growth that we want to help the city achieve. When we start talking about how we increase numbers of people with baccalaureate degrees, we've got a pretty challenging road ahead of us. I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that the university's doing to try to help us achieve these goals. First of all, as I said earlier, we are part of a state system. The state has also looked at what we as a state need need to achieve in terms of educational attainment at the baccalaureate level by the year 2020. And we need to double our production at the state level also. So what the state has done is set targets for all of the state universities in terms of number of increased people that need we need to enroll. U of L's numbers say that we're going to bring in about another 1,200 freshmen a year and eventually get to the point where we're graduating about another 3,000 students a year. What that will do cumulatively, it will bring our undergraduate enrollments from about 1,500, which we have now, to about 2,100, which is what the state would like us to have by 2020. Now, like Carolyn, I think that's going to be way too long, and we need to figure out how to get that number up faster. So there's a number of things that we're doing in three areas. One is to try to get more people coming to the university. Number two, trying to get more people moving through the university system more quickly. And number three, looking at how we bring new populations back into the system so that they can achieve baccalaureate degrees. So I'm going to just talk briefly about some of those are. In terms of the pipeline issues, one of the things that we know is that what happens to students in elementary school, middle school, high school is a really big indicator of how well they're going to be prepared to go to college. So we have a number of initiatives that are aimed toward middle school students, high school students, to get them on track to come to college. Some of those are things like our Upward Bound program, our Gear Up program. We're doing a lot of work right now with trying to go into the schools and get students excited about coming into math, coming into science, coming into engineering, going into nursing. You'll find a lot of our faculty in the high schools working to get students excited about chemistry, about engineering. We have, of course, part of the GE grant, which we and a number of other local universities are participating in, to try to better prepare teachers to teach math and science so that the kids can get excited about these areas, believe that they can do that, and be ready to go into many of these areas that we know our economy is going to be dependent on people having knowledge in. We're specifically, as I said, working on many of these STEM areas and again, trying to get people excited about math and science. Many of you probably saw our press conference last week where we introduced the Cardinal Covenant, which basically says anyone in the state of Kentucky who is at the 150% of the poverty level can come to the university for free. As, of course, we have been dependent more and more on tuition dollars, tuition keeps escalating. We know that for many people, the cost of college is itself a deterrent for going, and so we're trying to do our part to make sure that we keep college affordable. In addition to that, we put about $1.2 million a year into need-based financial aid. We have increased that every year, and about 47% of the students that come to the University of Louisville right now are either on some kind of aid program or on scholarships. So keeping college affordable is another thing that we think we can try to do. We also have some terrific partnerships so that we know that many students will come to U of L directly out of high school, but we also know that many of them, because of their background or because of their not quite readiness to engage in four-year college work, will start out in other schools or especially in the Jefferson Community and Technical College system. And we're really grateful to Tony for a number of programs that his faculty and staff have really partnered with us on. And those are things like what the state calls 2+2 programs, so that if you have an associate's degree, the university has been working to build degrees on that so that you can come right from the community college and technical system with your two-year degree and add on a university degree in 2 years so that you'll have a four-year degree at the end of that.
You've been listening to part of last week's Louisville Forum discussion about education and the Greater Louisville Project. More information is available at our website. Go to WFPL.org and click on Studio 619 under Select a Program. When we come back, WFPL's Julie Goodwin catches up on the latest offerings from Louisville's Speed Art Museum. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. The Speed Art Museum is offering several events for those searching for things to do on cold winter days. WFPL's Julie Goodwin spoke with Lana Versalis about the variety of activities being offered.
Lana, the Speed Art Museum is hosting many events this month and into February, and there's a couple of lectures coming up. Tell us about those.
Well, on Thursday, January 18th at 6 o'clock, we have a really wonderful talk with our curator of contemporary art, Julian Robson, and Louisville-based artist Stephen Irwin. Irwin's work looks at the body from both a material and spiritual perspective. And he has an installation here called Skin Diary, which we just acquired, and it's now going to be part of the museum's collection. So it should be a really interesting talk between the two of them, and I'm looking forward to that. And luckily for that, admission is free, so anybody can come on down and join us. And on January 25th, which is also a Thursday, we have the first Revive Lecture of the year, which will feature internationally renowned curator Akwiyin Wazor. He's best known for his direction of Documenta 11 in 2002. And Documenta is regarded as the world's most influential exhibition of modern and contemporary art. It charts the current trends in both theory and practice of contemporary art. So we're really excited to have him here. It's a very special honor. And he'll be discussing the work of Yinka Shonabare, whose work is also in our contemporary collection. And Shonabare likes to open up the debate about the social, cultural, and political issues that shape our histories and construct our identities. So that should be a very interesting discussion. And like I said, we're very honored to have him here. And admission to that lecture is free as well.
It looks like there's a very unique event coming up, a multicultural family event with the Louisville Ballet on January 27th. What will that include?
Well, that's going to be a lot of fun. That's one of our family days, and we have partnered with the Louisville Ballet to bring Lamborina, which is a multicultural family day. It's the celebration of African art, and we're going to have a lot of special performances. Members of the Louisville Ballet will be doing lecture demonstrations. We'll have live performances by the Imani Dance and Drum Company and the West Louisville Boys Choir. We'll have West African storytelling, and we'll have docent-led tours of the collection, interactive art projects, and a costume display, and a lot of just really fun stuff. And that's going to be from 12 o'clock to 3 o'clock on January 27th. So we're really excited about that one, and admission is free to that as well.
Those who are big fans of Hitchcock may consider the film screening of Vertigo, which will also include a lecture. Is this something that the Speed Art Museum typically does, to have film screenings, this type of thing?
We do provide film screenings every now and then. And this one's a pretty special one because following the screening, you know, Vertigo is considered just one of Hitchcock's masterpieces, and some people consider it the closest to perfection he's ever come in a movie. So it's really neat that after the film screening, we're going to have the lecture. It's a University of Louisville Morgan lecture where author Sandy McLendon will talk about the architecture of Vertigo and how Hitchcock used the San Francisco architecture and the surrounding geography to advance his plot. They'll also talk about how the costumes, the automobiles, the furnishings, and objects that are assigned to each of the Vertigo characters, how they extend the story and provide information and detail even more so than the script. So this should be a really fascinating discussion about the film. We're really excited about it.
And finally, the first week of February, a brand new exhibition opening there at the Speed. Tell us about that.
This is one of those really fun exhibitions, and it's Building Books, The Art of David McCauley. David McCauley is an author and illustrator of bestsellers like The Way Things Work, Cathedral, and Castles. These are really fun books. His illustrations are very detailed, and they really provide those aha moments for you where you're like, oh, I get it. That's how that works. He looks at everything from simple gadgets to large architectural structures, and he employs words and pictures to kind of reveal the secret lives of objects and emphasize how common sense, how much common sense is behind great design. So that's going to be a really fun exhibition that we're going to have. It starts February 6th, and tickets are available at the museum.
And how can listeners find out more about all these events happening in January and February?
We have a complete calendar listing at our website at www.speedmuseum.org, or people can call the museum at 502-634-2700.
Lana, thanks so much for talking to me today.
You're welcome, Julie. Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today's program. For more information about today's show, go to WFPL.org and click on Studio 619. You can email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 4022, or you can reach us by phone at 502-814-6500. Studio 619 is produced by the Public Radio Partnership. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at PRP, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. Alice Thompson provides website direction. I'm Rick Hallett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.